That brought a nervous laugh out of her. Word around the water cooler was that they'd be announcing his departure right at the close of work this Friday. No doubt he'd be launched off into the blue ocean of retirement with pomp and circumstance and cut-rate champagne, handed all around in disposable plastic flutes while corporate hotly debated the merits of candidates for his succession. If Jillian wanted her name in the SVP hat, she needed to close this account by 5 o'clock Friday, 3 days from now. And she desperately wanted her name in that hat. She reached the end of the long hall and stopped outside the door, her hand on the handle. Breathe. When she entered, he was bent over a stack of papers on his desk. He did not look up. She waited a full minute until he finally seemed to notice that she was there. Sit, sit, he said, gesturing vaguely. He returned to his papers, now slowly shaking his head, and Jillian took her seat at a chair perched by the corner of his desk. Muttering over the papers, he picked up a pen and began marking out lines. No, he growled to himself, punctuating each cross-out with a spoken negation. No, 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 and, he said this last with a note of triumph and an especially firm pen stroke, no. He set the pen down and looked up at Jillian. Yes? How many times had she entered this office and sat here for an audience with his cornerness? A dozen, at least. Maybe 20. And she never got used to it. Never managed to find a way to feel at ease. Never got over the conviction that when she opened her mouth to speak, she would stutter unmercifully. Which she never had, of course. But really, wasn't there a first time for everything? Yes, sir. It's about the Jackson Hill account. He gazed at her, a hawk pondering the fate of an unwary mouse. Nodded. Angels in the nude. He pronounced it nude. Clothed in fur, yes, sir, she said, and instantly berated herself for correcting him. It was a joke, she told herself. He was making a joke, though she saw no humor in those pale blue eyes. Brilliant concept, strong buzz, a good skew. What's the issue? Issue. As succinctly as possible, and without a single stutter, Jillian explained Jackson's hopes to secure their underwriting for the funding of his chain of kitchens, so he could... Why does he need that? He sliced into the middle of her sentence like a scalpel. We can ship his stuff anywhere, any distance, at the cost of less than dirt. We already have the requisite national distribution machinery in place. It's a question of freshness, sir, explained Jillian. Local sourcing. I mean, that's central to his whole brand. And honestly, it's better for the animals. The senior vice president stared at her. Not a word. Just as the stare had gone on for so long that Jillian felt she must have missed something, he must have said something, he must be waiting for her to respond to something he said that she somehow didn't hear, he leaned back slowly in his chair, steepled his fingers, and smiled thinly. You know, rumor has it there's a position opening up soon, somewhere around here. I've heard that, sir, said Jillian. I try not to pay too much attention to rumors. Don't you? He grunted. Grinned. Then nodded, and the grin vanished as abruptly as it had appeared. Good, Waters. She had no idea what he meant by that. The SVP flapped his hand vaguely, a gesture that seemed to say, whatever it is, take care of it. See what you can do to bring Mr. Hill around. He doesn't need any more kitchens. He needs distribution. We have it. Yes, sir. It's a good skew, Waters. Good buzz. It'll be an asset. As she thanked the senior vice president of distribution, left the corner office, and made the long trek down the hall to her own office, Jillian Waters had just one thought. Is that me 30 years from now? Sure, that's fine. 10 o'clock. Yep. Thanks, Ms. Waters. Jackson Hill clicked off, set his phone down, and frowned. Another meeting? So soon? All that day, Jackson worried about it. He tried not to, but it was like working a sore tooth with your tongue. He couldn't stop himself. The moment he sat down to dinner that evening, Walt dragged it out of him. How was the deal going? It was going fine, Pop. Really? It didn't sound fine. What happened today? Well, he'd been summoned for a second meeting. Not the Friday meeting, that was still on, but an interim meeting. Why? Jackson didn't know. Something must be up. Of course something's up, said Walt. She went and talked to Mr. Corner office, that's what's up. Now she's going to corner you. Ha! He chuckled at his own joke. See, he said, and he popped a bite in his mouth and worked his jaw. This was one of Walt's favorite conversational tactics. He would start a sentence with just a word or two. See, or thing is, or that said, and then he had the table locked down. You couldn't say anything yourself, no matter how long he paused at that point to eat, drink, or whatever, because if you did, you'd be interrupting. Jackson waited. See, Walt said again after another bite or two, you told her you didn't need the company's actual backing, just their underwriting. That was a tactical mistake. You never tell him what you actually want. That's suicide. You need to use the compromise. Tell them that you need, absolutely, positively, non-negotiably must have, something that's way more than what you're really looking for. You want to walk out of there with the moon? Tell them you need the whole solar system. Nothing less will work. Knowing they'll say, eh, listen, we can't do the solar system. Best we can do is the planet Earth. And when they do, and you say, now all generous and agreeable, hey, I want to work with you here. Let's split the difference. Just throw in the moon as a gesture of goodwill, and me and my people will figure out how to make it work without all those other planets. You make them feel like you're meeting them halfway. When what's really happened is, you've maneuvered them into giving you what you wanted in the first place. Jackson said something halfway between an agreement and an argument, but it didn't really matter what. Walt wasn't listening. He was chewing, gazing off at nothing. Jackson knew that look. He was reliving his glory days. Then there's the stall, he continued. You find reasons to keep the process moving along, slowly, slowly, stumbling block by stumbling block. Meanwhile, you're waiting till the last possible minute to make your biggest ask. The more you can string someone along, the more they feel invested in the deal, and the more likely they'll succumb to any last-minute demands, unfair as they may be. I can't believe they're pulling this on me at the last minute, but I've been working on getting this sale for 6 months now, and it's not worth losing all that time, energy, and effort. So they give in. Now he refocused on Jackson. Of course, that only works when you can afford to invest the time. You can't. Fact is, it sounds like she already used the stall on you. So, forget that one. He stabbed another bite of dinner, chewed, and swallowed. You're in a tight spot. Stab, chew, swallow. Stab, and he pointed his fork-pinioned bite at Jackson. What you need is the takeaway. And you make it clear that your terms are more than fair, and if they can't meet you there, you'll have to take the offer off the table, and that you have no problem walking away from the deal. Which, of course, you have absolutely no intention of doing, but they don't know that. I'm not so sure that would play well, Pop, ventured Jackson. If I threatened to walk away, my guess is they'd just let me walk away. Look, said Walt, they want your business. This meeting wouldn't be happening if they didn't. You think they've got you over a barrel, son, but you're wrong. You're the one in a position of strength here. They're saying they expect you to go from local to national, just like that, and not assume any of the risk themselves? Ha! They're posturing. You're in the right here, Jackie. Don't roll over. Fight for what you want. You're in the right here, Jackie. Fight for what you want. Jackson sat up in bed, thinking about the conversation with Walt and about how different it was from his conversation with the judge. Strangely enough, though, they shared one thing in common. They both had made it clear that Jackson did not have the first clue what was going on in Ms. Waters' mind. He picked up that ledger book he'd started writing in the night before and looked at the cover. My contract with myself. He reread what he'd written for the first clause, then turned to the next blank page and wrote, 2. Step into the other person's shoes. Get out of your own head and step into the other person's perspective. See the world through their lenses. Appreciate where they're coming from. What's at stake for them? He closed the book and set it back on his nightstand. It's always helpful to see the other side, she had said. He hoped he'd be able to do that in his meeting with Ms. Waters the next day. He hoped he would be able to keep his feelings in the passenger seat and make calm his default setting. Solomon began to snore.
Chapter 9. Set the Frame. When Jillian stepped through the door of the Juice Caboose on Wednesday morning, there was a young girl at her side, all limbs, knees, and elbows, like a baby deer. A baby deer with big, solemn eyes. Jillian spread her hands apologetically. We're on our way to a riding lesson this morning. I hope it's okay. The coach looked down at the girl. You like horses? She turned her big eyes up at him, two silent full moons, and nodded. They are beautiful, aren't they? More solemn nodding. Such noble, gentle creatures. He glanced up at the menu on the wall, then turned to Jillian. What would... Beau, said Jillian. I'm sorry. Beau, this is George, the coach. George, this is my daughter, Beau. I'm pleased to meet you, Beau, said the coach. Would you like a glass of juice to drink? Anything, any kind at all. Apple juice, orange juice, alfalfa juice, hay juice. She giggled. Yes, please. She spoke so quietly that she barely made a sound. Do they have almond milk? He gave her a serious nod. I'm pretty sure they do. He ordered his celery juice and a glass of cold almond milk for Beau. When Jillian had placed her order, a repeat of the pear, beet, ginger, pineapple, he insisted on paying for all three. They made their way to the back of the counter and took the last three seats. The coach, then Jillian, then Beau. Before clambering up onto her stool, Beau looked over at the coach. Thank you for the almond milk, she said, her voice no more than a rustling of leaves. You are very, very welcome, said the coach. Jillian smiled at him, a faltering smile, all at once feeling oddly emotional. So, she said, sitting up straighter. The coach turned to her. Yes, of course. So, on to our continuing series on Coach George's winning strategy. He stretched out the word winning to make it sound like a horse's whinny. Beau giggled. Third secret, he said. And he held up three fingers. Smile. Jillian frowned. Smile? That's a $1 million business secret? It is. Smile. But not just with your face. With your body, your attitude, your mind. What you do when you smile, when you genuinely smile, with all of you, is you set the parameters of the game. You call it. Okay, said Jillian. Unconvincingly. You know who Babe Ruth was, right? Said the coach. Jillian and Beau glanced at each other, then turned in unison to give the coach a look. Duh, said Beau. The coach blurted out a laugh so abrupt that he choked on his juice. Beau, said Jillian. Sorry, said Beau in less than a whisper. No, no, the coach said, coughing and mopping the edges of his mouth with a napkin. You're quite right. Duh, indeed. Of course you do. Well, you know that thing that Babe did once, that he became so famous for, right before hitting it out of the park? Jillian looked at Bo, who stuck out one arm, forefinger pointing. Exactly, said the coach. Before he made his move, he told everyone exactly what was going to happen. He set the parameters of the game. He called it. Jack Nicklaus, the golfer, used to say 90% of golf is preparing and lining up the shot. And that doesn't just work for golf. It's also true in any kind of human interaction, which includes business, because all business is nothing but human interaction. Bo was tugging on Jillian's arm quietly. What is it, Bo Bird? Said Jillian. Bo pulled her mother's shoulder down so she could whisper in her ear. Jillian pointed toward the rear of the place. Right back there. Without a word, Bo slipped down off her stool and walked back to where the restrooms were located. Old soul, said the coach, a comment that caught Jillian by surprise. Yeah, well, she said, she's been through a lot. She sipped at her beverage, her eyes on the restroom door. Bo was 5 years old when her father and I split up. It was really hard on her. On both of us, she didn't add. Just a few days after we moved into the place we have now, a stray cat showed up in our backyard. Poor thing was nothing but skin and bones. Within a few weeks, that skinny little cat had glommed onto Bo like superglue. They became inseparable. Bo wanted to name her Cleopatra, only she said it Cleocatra, and the name stuck. As she got older, she eventually realized she had got the name wrong, but Cleocatra it is to this day. The coach chuckled. That cat was Bo's companion and greatest comfort during those hard years. As Bo grew up, so did Cleo. I let her sleep on Bo's bed every night. Some nights she licked the tears from Bo's face. Jillian's voice wobbled slightly. Some nights she just listened while Bo told her what had happened that day. I heard her through the door. She said this last so apologetically that the coach nodded, as if to say, "That's all right, you weren't violating her privacy." At night, while Bo was sleeping, Cleo would slip up to her pillow and settle in by her head. Sometimes she would lick her hair while she was asleep, so that when Bo came out for breakfast, her hair would be sticking out like a mohawk. The coach chuckled again. Just then, Bo reappeared. Jillian looked at her, questioning wordlessly. Everything all right? Bo nodded as she climbed up on her stool. Your mom and I were just talking about Cleocatra, said the coach, and what good friends you two are. Bo turned her eyes to the coach and nodded solemnly. Cleo is the best. She found us when she was little. Your mom told me, replied the coach. Said she was skinny and hungry. Bo now turned her eyes back on Jillian. You tell it. She looked like she hadn't eaten in days, said Jillian, hiding in the bushes, jumping at every sound. She wouldn't even take water from the paper bowl we set out, as long as we were nearby. We left it there, and once we were gone, she crept out and drank a little. Jillian's voice caught. Why was she getting so emotional? Then you tried to feed her, Bo prompted. Jillian nodded and went on. As long as I was around, she'd have nothing to do with it. When I walked away, she would eventually slip out to eat. I started placing the bowl closer and closer to our back door. As long as I didn't get too close and she knew she had room to escape, she'd eat. Within a week, she ventured onto the patio to eat, as long as we were on the other side of the glass door and left the patio door itself open. As she ate, she would constantly dart her eyes back to that door, making sure it was still open. A week after that, she actually slipped inside the house to eat, right at the edge of the open glass door. Then she let me stand at the door near her, as long as I kept it open. One day I thought I'd see if she might be okay with my closing the door. I moved very, very slowly. But the moment I began to slide the door closed, she stopped eating and looked like she was about to rip out of there at the speed of light. I immediately opened the door again, as wide as it would go. She paused. And she stood still, Bo whispered. Jillian nodded. She did. She stood there like a statue for what seemed like an hour. So did I. And then, Finally, she relaxed and went back to eating. After a few more tries, I was able to close the door. She's been part of our family ever since. Jillian stopped talking, not trusting her voice. Suddenly, she felt self-conscious. Hadn't they already taken up way more than 5 minutes? I'm sorry, I'm going on and on. You called it, said the coach. Jillian looked at him, uncomprehending. Like the babe, pointing at the fence. You pointed at the door, set the parameters of the game, made the cat feel safe. Cleo, whispered Beau. The coach nodded. Yes, Cleo. You made Cleo feel safe. She didn't want to leave. She just wanted to know she could leave. So long as she had a back door to escape through, she was fine. He paused. Remember what I said about collaboration a few days ago? Jillian replied without hesitation. Winning in business is about collaboration, and the substance of collaboration is persuasion. The coach's eyebrows shot up. Good memory. A smile touched the corners of Jillian's mouth. I was listening. He touched two fingers to his forehead in a salute. Touché. Well, there's more. The substance of persuasion is influence. Genuine influence. Because all of this, negotiation, persuasion, solving problems, winning in business, ultimately, at its core, is all about influence. And as a dear friend of mine says, the substance of influence is pull, not push. If you want to persuade, don't push, don't confront, and don't shut the patio door. Never box the other person into a corner where they feel they have no choice, where they feel they have to agree with your point of view, because then, of course, they never will. Always leave a back door open. Jillian thought back to her meeting with Jackson Hill. He had looked as spooked as poor starving little Cleo. Had she given him a back door? Which reminded her, Beau had a horseback lesson to get to, and she had a meeting with Mr. Hill. We should go, she said, and stood up. Beau slipped off her stool, looked up at the coach, and said, she was smiling. Hmm? Said the coach. My mom, with Cleo. A soft smile stole over the coach's face. He crouched down to get eye level with the girl, which for the coach didn't take much of a crouch, and said, you are absolutely right. He looked up at Jillian, smart girl. Jillian gave a puzzled frown. When you left that door open, he said, that was you, smiling. Jackson was not smiling, not at all, and the judge had noticed this right away. She was having the huevos rancheros. Unbelievable, was her murmured assessment, and he was having, of course, the oatmeal, or not having it. The judge was just starting to walk Jackson through the third clause of natural negotiation, but she sensed he was only half listening. He seemed vaguely unsettled, even irritable. Perhaps, she thought, there'd be an opportunity to ask about that. Perhaps. She would have to wait and see. She continued with her dissertation from the bench. Set the frame, repeated Jackson. Set the frame, the judge said again. That's the third clause. The frame is more important than the content because the frame is the context. Whoever sets the frame of the conversation also sets the tone and the direction in which it will go. For example, in your meeting last Friday, who set the frame? Jackson thought about that for a moment. I'm not sure. I think maybe I did. Tell me, describe it to me, how it started. Well, she asked me to tell her about my business. So I told her, no, before that, how did it start exactly? I don't remember exactly, Jackson snapped back. He sighed, more loudly than he meant to. I'm sorry, he said. I'm just... He pushed his plate of oatmeal a few inches farther away and sighed a second time. Hang on, let me think for a sec. The judge gave one small nod and gestured with her hand. Don't worry about it. Take your time. Jackson frowned and thought. Exactly how had that conversation started? He closed his eyes and thought back. Looking at her desk. That picture of the girl and the cat. He opened his eyes. She called me Mr. Hall. The judge nodded gravely, as if to say, of course she did. And? I corrected her, and she said she was sorry for getting it wrong, then asked me to tell her about my business. She said she was sorry? Jackson nodded. What did she say exactly? He frowned again. She said, of course, Mr. Hill, Jackson. So tell me about your business. Ah, so she didn't really apologize for getting your name wrong. No, she hadn't, had she? She hadn't said sorry, as in, I'm sorry. She'd said, sorry? As in, huh? Could you say that again? I wasn't really listening. What happened before that, before you stepped into her office? Nothing, really. I just waited. I was there on time. Well ahead of time, actually, but I didn't get in to see her till 10 or 11 passed. The judge said nothing. Wow, said Jackson, as the penny dropped. The judge nodded. Exactly. Jackson, she set the frame 100 ways from Sunday. She had you wait, as if she were far busier than you were, that is, more important than you were. When you walked in, rather than greeting you, she kept studying her file on your business, as if she'd been too occupied with other matters, other more important matters, to actually read what you'd sent her until the moment you were already sitting right there in her office. And do you really think she didn't know your correct name? Or let me put it this way. She had a scheduled meeting with you to discuss the possibility of taking on your business as a major account for her company. How could she possibly not have known your name? Wow, said Jackson again. Wow, indeed. She set a frame that said, I have the upper hand from the very first moment on, and you and I both know it, so shall we just get down to brass tacks? From the sound of it, your Ms. Waters would make a formidable trial attorney. Jackson shook his head slowly in disbelief. Wow, he said a third time. Then, for the first time that morning, his face did something that resembled a hint of a smile. So you're saying, I was framed? I bet you heard that a lot in the courtroom. That deep, throaty laugh again. Yes, she said. In fact, that is the truth. Everyone is framed, one way or another. Do you know the word semiotics? It has to do with the creation of meaning. Because language is more than language, it's also a creative force. The language you use to describe the situation sets up the situation. And not only words, but gestures, tone, posture, everything. Some words and phrases, like some physical postures, automatically set up an antagonistic frame, a frame where one side dominates over the other, or attempts to. Jackson nodded, like getting my name wrong. Yes, though you can just as easily set a frame that fosters connection and agreement rather than dominance or antagonism. For example, do you remember what transpired the first time you walked into this restaurant 2 days ago? Jackson thought back. At first, I wasn't sure I was in the right place, so I waited in line for a minute and then asked the barista if she knew where you were. And she said? She told me. She pointed right over to where you were sitting. And then said? No problem, or something. The judge waited. Jackson thought again for a moment, bringing the scene back. No, that wasn't it. She said, my pleasure. The judge nodded once. Exactly. Wait, said Jackson. How do you know she said that? You were sitting way over here. You couldn't possibly have heard us. That's what she always says, replied the judge. It's what every barista and server at every Rachel's Famous establishment says from coast to coast and around the world. And that's not an accident. It's in their training, directly from Rachel herself. So tell me, what have you heard servers at other breakfast shops or takeout counters say when you place an order? No problem, said Jackson. Right back at you. Hey, just doing my job. There was another cascade of laughter from the judge. It never fails to amaze me, the things people say. No problem, for instance. Really? Should it have to be pointed out that your being here, placing an order, is not a problem? Or if he's just doing his job? How does that make you feel? Like your thanks were not appropriate because he was only doing what he was told? And right back at you. What does that even mean? But when they say, my pleasure, it creates a whole different context. It sets a powerfully positive frame. I see that, said Jackson. He'd never imagined that you could communicate so much with just two words. But then look at how much Solomon communicated with no words at all. One of my favorite judges, said the judge, was a master of setting the frame. He wasn't officially a judge. He was officially the president. But he'd spent years as a very successful lawyer before he was called upon to preside over one of the worst disputes this nation has ever witnessed. Mr. Lincoln had a very unusual style as a trial lawyer. He would typically begin his opening arguments by summing up the other side's case, pointing out the positive aspects of their position and how very worthy they were of sober consideration. In fact, it was said that if you'd walked into the courtroom at the moment he was giving his opening remarks, you'd have assumed he was representing the opposing side. She paused to lay into the rest of her huevos rancheros, her eyes never leaving Jackson as she ate. Okay, said Jackson. Interesting approach for a trial lawyer. He was thinking of Keith's story, about how the lawyer brought in by the other side ended up getting him a settlement. Then he remembered that that same lawyer, turned judge, turned mediator, was sitting right here across from him, demolishing her breakfast. The judge nodded as she dabbed a napkin to her lips. Sounds strange, I know. But by doing this, Mr. Lincoln was establishing his credibility with the judge and jury, and demonstrating that both sides had a legitimate view and that he was seeking only the truth. When it came time to present his side of the dispute, he would really pour it on, offering up point after point, fact after fact, to make his client's case. It was like, and forgive the sports metaphor, taking the ball and running 70 yards for a touchdown through an open field, with no defensive players left to stop him. Because by this point his credibility level was so high. After all, if he was so forthright about the strengths of the other side's position, then he must be honest and speaking straight from his heart. Right? And here's the key. When he presented that other side, he was being sincere. Yes, it was clever, and yes, it was calculated. But it wasn't phony. Which is one of the central tenets of effective frame setting. You have to mean it. Jackson said, like, my pleasure. Yes, she said, exactly like that. She poured out some fresh hot coffee, then looked over at him. Jackson, she said, do you remember how this conversation began? I mean, right now, this morning, when you first sat down? Jackson blushed. Yeah, sorry about that. I was upset, nervous about this meeting coming up today. I didn't mean to be rude. So, who set the frame? He didn't say anything for a moment. Then, I'm not sure. You? Me. But I don't see how you set any frame at all. You didn't say or do anything. I was the one who snapped at you and sulked over my oatmeal. Didn't that set a frame? Well, she said, it could have. She took one last swallow of coffee and raised one finger to signal she was ready for the check. Sometimes, though, not reacting is the most powerful statement you can make. When you go to your default setting of calm, that is itself a frame reset. Or at the very least, it sets the stage for one. So yes, your mood did set a certain frame, but I reset it. There's always a frame being set. Always. The only question is, who will set it? As Jackson Hill left Rachel's Famous Coffee and headed across town toward the offices of Smith and Banks for his interim meeting with Ms. Waters, his thoughts kept going back to his conversation with Walt the night before. You're in the right here, Walt said, and Jackson had to admit he had a point. They were expecting him to scale up to national in just months and give up his best accounts in the process? Clearly that wasn't fair, and it made Jackson mad. He was in the right here. He thought about what the judge had said, too. There's always a frame being set. The only question is, who will set it? He tried to think through how these next few minutes would go.
Chapter 10. Collision. Jillian Waters stared out her office window, thinking through what needed to happen in the next few minutes. "Breathe, Joe," she murmured. "Listen. Smile." She took a deep breath, in and out, in and out. Put a big smile on her face, then turned back to her desk, pressed the talk button, and said, "Mirabel, could you send Mr. Hill in now?" Jackson Hill looked like a man ready to shoot, if necessary, to protect his farm from the hostiles. As he got up from his seat in reception, he glanced at the wall clock. Right on the dot of the hour. Good. He nodded once at Mirabel as he walked past her desk and down the hall. "Set the frame, Jackson. Be the one who sets the frame." As he stepped into the office for his meeting, Ms. Waters stood up and reached across her desk, hand outstretched. "Thank you for coming in on such short notice," she said, as she shook his hand. "How is it going?" she inquired as he took his seat. "Going?" said Jackson. "With your accounts." "All right." He was supposed to be talking with his people, preparing for a graceful withdrawal of commitment, or however she'd put it. "It's going fine," he said. Of course, he hadn't placed a single call. Why would he? He already knew what they would say. He didn't have to explore anything. He knew these people. "I dropped by the Pet Nook yesterday," said Ms. Waters. "The one down on Dale Drive, next to the big furniture place. Talked with Patty there. They were singing your praises." Jackson was totally confused. You know Patty?" "Not really," said Ms. Waters. "I mean, just to say hello whenever I'm in." "You shop at the Pet Nook?" Had he just dropped into some alternative universe? Ms. Waters was an executive for the country's largest pet food and accessories chain, and she shopped at a competitor's place? At one of his little accounts? "Well," said Ms. Waters, "we aren't carrying your line yet, are we? I have to buy your cat food somewhere." "Wait, you buy my..." He glanced again at the photo on her desk. "The Russian blue. You use my product." Ms. Waters put her elbows on her desk and leaned forward to look directly at him. "Of course I do. Purest, freshest, best. It's not just a slogan, right?" Jackson's mind was going 100 miles an hour. Ms. Waters knew who Patty was? One of his accounts. A real-life person, not just an arithmetic problem. As segues went, it didn't get any more perfect than this. The words were on his lips, "Speaking of which, I wanted to ask just how exclusive is exclusive," when Ms. Waters spoke up again. "I spoke with the corner office yesterday about your underwriting idea. They have questions." Jackson's heart sank. Questions. She might as well have said, "They think you're poison." All at once it came to him with total clarity. Walt was right. Jackson should never have said he was interested only in their underwriting his loan. That was a tactical mistake, all right, a classic blunder. Hopefully, not a fatal one. But what could he do now? What was it Walt said? "If you want the moon, ask for the solar system." Jackson felt his heart pounding in his chest. "Well, actually," he said, "I wanted to talk about that. Production on a national scale, well, that's a major investment, and one that would benefit both our companies. I wanted to explore the idea of cost sharing on that." "They'll fold like dominoes." Was that how Walt had put it? He stopped talking, hoping against hope that Ms. Waters would fold like dominoes. Ms. Waters did not fold like dominoes. Not like origami, not like a basket of clean laundry, not like anything at all. All that happened was a frosty silence. "So let's review," she said. "You were hoping we'd back your capital improvement loan with a signature And now you're saying, no, in fact, you'd like us to pay for it? Another silence. Jackson was just about to fold himself and blurt out something, probably some form of backpedaling, when Ms. Waters began nodding slowly and added, interesting. Jackson's mind raced. Interesting. Was that good? Or just her way of saying, ha, you must be kidding. He flashed on the judge, saying, step into her shoes. That's what he needed to do. Ha, step into her shoes? He couldn't even guess what her shoes looked like behind that desk, much less step into them. The woman was a cipher to him, a mystery wrapped in an enigma. He tried to remember what the judge had said just that morning, barely an hour earlier. But what leapt into his mind was Walt saying, what you need is the takeaway. He panicked. I'm not sure about the whole exclusive thing either, he said. I don't see why we shouldn't be able to work something out there, too. Some kind of compromise, where I can continue servicing a small circle of my existing clients. Maybe call them legacy accounts. Maybe special label the line for them so it doesn't directly compete with what's in your stores. Or, and at that, Jackson Hill's train of thought crashed head-on into a concrete barrier and collapsed in a ruined heap. Or something, he concluded, hoping that didn't come off as lame as it sounded, but knowing that it did. After another chilly silence, Jillian spoke up in that same softer tone he'd briefly heard in their first meeting. Look, Mr. Hill, I want you to know we want your account. We really do. We think what you've done here is, it's impressive. It's, well, it represents exactly what this company stands for, at least as far as I'm concerned. The shift caught Jackson by surprise, and for a moment he felt he was being given a glimpse into who this person was. But an instant later the window slid closed, and the temperature in the room dropped once more. But you need to meet me halfway, she said, and if you can't budge on these two points, then I'm not sure I really see a path forward here. She looked at him, not exactly a glare, but nothing Jackson would have mistaken for being warm and fuzzy. And just like that, without either one of them quite knowing how it had happened, their meeting was over. As he slipped past Mirabelle's desk and showed himself out the door, it dawned on Jackson that he hadn't used the takeaway on Ms. Waters at all. She had used it on him. Jillian stared out her office window, trying to see just where and how that meeting had gone so terribly wrong. She turned back to her desk and looked at the photo. Beau and Cleo. Way to go, Jill. You certainly slammed that back door, didn't you? After his walk with Solomon, Jackson dropped Sol off at home and went out to dinner by himself. He couldn't face dinner with Walt tonight. When he got home, he went straight to his bedroom and got into his pajamas. He sat on the edge of his bed and looked into Solomon's big, droopy eyes as he scratched his jaw with both hands. I should have brought you to that meeting. Solomon licked his hand, then put his forepaws up on the bed and licked Jackson's face. I should have stayed home and let you go do the meeting. Sol settled back onto his big dog bed on the floor, circled himself 4 or 5 times, then adjusted his big bones into a comfortable heap and let out a big huffing sigh, followed by a groan of comfort. Jackson realized he was still circling the meeting, just like Saul, around and around. Only unlike Solomon, Jackson couldn't seem to settle. He reached over, took up the ledger book he'd written in the previous 2 evenings, and dropped it in the wastebasket by his bed. He switched off the bedside light, turned over, and thought about sleep. Saul began to snore. 3 or 4 minutes later, Jackson sat up and switched back on the light. He reached down and pulled the little book out of the wastebasket again and set it on his lap. He turned to the next blank page and wrote, 3. Set the frame. Take the initiative to establish the tone and context of the interaction. Whoever sets the frame of the conversation also sets the direction and tone in which it will go. He settled back onto his pillows and let himself walk through that meeting once again, this time not to circle what he'd done wrong, but to think through what Jillian Waters had said. What are the stakes for her? The judge had asked. Jackson felt, just for a moment, that he'd gotten a sense of that. "We think what you've done here is impressive," she'd said. "It represents exactly what this company stands for." And then she'd added, "At least, as far as I'm concerned." What was that about? It occurred to him that maybe she had to go and really sell this deal to her superiors. He'd never considered that possibility. Maybe for her, going to talk to the corner office was a lot like how it was for him to go before his bank officer. Maybe her dreams and aspirations were on the chopping block here, too. In his sleep, Solomon said, "Woof."
Chapter 11, Grace. At 8 o'clock Thursday morning, Jillian emerged from a downtown parking garage blinking in the sunlight. She made her way halfway down Dale Drive, past the pet nook, where she really had gotten into the habit of shopping for Cleo's cat food, and stopped at an address she'd never noticed before, a nondescript door tucked between Allen and Augustine, the big furniture place, and another large operation. There was no sign over the door. She stepped inside and followed a long corridor to where it opened onto a large room filled with small circular tables, around which sat small rings of children eating and talking, in most cases both at once. In the middle of the room stood a long buffet-style array of steam tables, racked with stacks of bowls and plates, trays and napkins, staffed by 3 people busily serving their small fry patrons. Closest to Jillian stood a gigantic man in an apron. He was so big he reminded her of a guy Bo and she had seen on TV just that week, a star player with their city's basketball team. Next to him, a short, elderly woman in a hairnet, hunched over a huge pan of what Jillian guessed was sweet potato hash browns. The third server was George, the coach. Just then, the gigantic man glanced up at a wall clock, murmured something to the hairnet woman, whipped off his apron, and headed for the door where Jillian was standing. At the same moment, another huge man appeared behind Jillian and sidled past her toward the table, where he took the first man's place. "Hey, coach," she heard him say. Then, "Hey, Mrs. B." "Morning, Marvin," the woman said without looking up as she continued dishing out steaming hot servings of hash browns. As the first gigantic man approached Jillian, nodded in greeting, and made his way past her and out into the corridor, she realized why he had reminded her so much of the star basketball player. He was the star basketball player. And the huge man who had just replaced him on the serving line? Quarterback of the city's football team. This was some breakfast crew the coach hung out with. As if hearing her thoughts, the coach glanced up and saw her at the door. He waved her over. Just as Jillian reached the tables, so did a trio of children with empty trays, clearly angling for seconds, which the hairnet woman began enthusiastically serving. Jillian heard her address one as Master Ryan and another as Miss Tamika, as if she were addressing royalty. She all but curtsied. The coach walked Jillian a distance away and began talking with her quietly. "Thanks for coming. I wanted to introduce you to a friend of mine." This would certainly be a first for Jillian. She'd never met a football star before. Bo would freak when she heard about this. "Most of these kids," the coach was saying, his voice soft and low, "come from homes that send them off to school on breakfast that wouldn't keep a mouse alive, or no breakfast at all. Sometimes it's a matter of economics. Sometimes it's just plain dysfunction, abusive households, drug-addicted parents. Whatever it is, as Elizabeth says, we probably can't fix it, but we can make sure they're fed. And they are. We feed over 500 hungry kids here every weekday morning before school. Elizabeth is Mrs. B? Whispered Jillian. The coach nodded. We all switch off. Thursday's mine, along with Marvin, Bobby, that was the departed basketball center, and a few others. Elizabeth's supposed to take Fridays, but she shows up pretty much every day. He leaned closer and said, she's kind of a crazy old bat. To Jillian's mortification, he spoke this last a little less softly. Could the woman have heard? Didn't look like it. She was still busily serving away. You don't have to shout, the woman called over. I may be old, but I'm not deaf. And yes, George, I can hear every word you're saying. The coach's shoulders shook in silent laughter as they walked back towards the serving tables and the trio of kids headed back for their seats, bearing their tray of riches. The woman put her serving spoon down, sat back on a stool, and looked at Jillian and the coach. If they don't eat, they can't think. If they can't think, she stripped off the thin rubber gloves she was wearing, they can't read. And if they can't read, I don't sleep. She pulled off her hairnet and reached one hand out toward Jillian. Elizabeth, said the coach, this is the young woman I was telling you about. Jillian, meet Elizabeth, also known as Mrs. B. As Jillian shook the woman's hand, she finally recognized who was standing in front of her. The wall in the coach's little office on the row. The photos on the wall. The philanthropist in the photo on the wall. Jillian was shaking hands with one of the most admired figures in the city. It wasn't the football star the coach brought Jillian here to meet this morning after all. It was Elizabeth Bushnell? Well, said Mrs. B., it's very nice to meet you. I used to coach her son, Tom, the coach was explaining. Another boxer. Jillian nodded numbly. Thomas J. Bushnell, CEO of one of the largest corporations in the region. Another boxer. And later, when I went into business, she started coaching me. George told me you work with animals, said Mrs. B., brightly. How wonderful. I grew up with a beautiful Arabian. Mahogany, we called her. Such a gentle soul. And so intelligent. My best friend in the world in those early years. Her gaze, which had grown distant, now refocused on Jillian. She smiled and patted the younger woman's arm. I've always wanted to do something special for animals. They give us so much love and loyalty, and ask so little in return. Sweet, sweet creatures. She glanced around the room. Like these little ones. Jillian followed her glance and nodded. I noticed how you treat these kids. It's like, well, like they're royalty. Every one of these children needs food in their bellies, said Mrs. B. Providing that is the easy part. We also make sure we send them off with some self-respect and dignity under their belts. Malnourishment, sad to say, comes in many forms. She headed back to the serving center as more kids swarmed. And that, said the coach, is why I wanted you to meet her. He held up four fingers, a walking, talking example of the fourth secret. They both stood watching Marvin and Mrs. B serving their new batch of customers. Look at those two, said the coach. You see what they have in common? Just then, Marvin bent down over the table and gently bumped fists with a little girl who looked to be about a quarter of his height, then straightened up again with a big smile. He towered over Mrs. B like a skyscraper dropped into a hamlet. What did they have in common? Jillian saw it, but couldn't quite put a name to it. Grace, said the coach. You know why a cat always lands on its feet? Because it never loses poise. Take high-speed photos of a cat jumping off a wall, even of a cat falling off a wall, and you'll see the same thing in every single frame. Grace. A cat is always graceful, no matter what. A good athlete is like that. Always graceful in every moment. Graceful in action, graceful in thought, and gracious in conduct. Which is the fourth secret of the winning strategy. Be gracious. Gracious. That did seem a good description of this entire scene. When Elizabeth started coaching me, the very first thing she taught me was also the most important thing she taught me. Have a kind and generous spirit, George, she said. A kind and generous spirit always wins. And you know why that is? I didn't, of course. I never know the answers to the questions she asks. Jillian could easily imagine that. The woman had a sort of oracular quality. Sphinx in a hairnet. The coach turned to face Jillian. Because, she said, gratitude is the secret to all magnificent success. They were quiet for a few moments, those last eight words echoing in Jillian's brain like a thunderclap, until the silence was broken by Mrs. B's voice calling over to them. Same route, you know. Jillian and the coach both turned back in her direction. Ma'am? Said Jillian. Gratitude, she said. Same root word as grace and gracious, from the Latin gratia, meaning favor, esteem, regard, a pleasing quality, goodwill, and before that from earlier roots meaning to announce, sing, praise, celebrate. In English, its first meaning was more like divine favor, love, or assistance. Typically unmerited assistance, by the way, but freely given anyway. Grace. Wonderful, wonderful word. The coach turned back to Jillian. Crazy old bat, he said quietly. I heard that, Mrs. B called out. I know, the coach whispered, grinning like a schoolboy. While Jillian marveled at the fact that she was meeting one of the wealthiest women in the state, Jackson was back at Rachel's Famous, watching Celia Henshaw put away a large plate of peach pancakes dripping with real maple syrup and topped with French vanilla whipped cream. How did the woman do it, all that food, and stay so lean and fit? I walk 5 miles a day, she commented, as she touched a napkin to her lips and poured herself some hot coffee. It gives me time to... She gestured to her head with her left hand as she took a swallow of coffee with her right. Time to think? Actually, she said, setting the coffee back down, time to not think. A rare and precious thing, my golden hour. She glanced at his plate of oatmeal, which he had scarcely touched. Can't I tempt you? He looked at her peach pancakes. Looks amazing, but that's okay. I'm good. You don't seem terribly hungry, she observed dryly. Tough day at the office, dear? Jackson gave a faint smile. Wasn't that exactly what Keith had said? Terrible, actually. That interim meeting yesterday? I definitely did not master my emotions. They totally mastered me. My feelings weren't just driving the car, they drove it off the highway and crashed it into an embankment. He looked at her miserably. I'm dead. You're talking to a ghost. She laughed that familiar honey and butter laugh. A little drama this morning. I love it. So much for the first clause. Am I to suppose you also did not exactly step into Ms. Waters' shoes? I think I may have stepped all over her feet. Does that count? The judge laughed again, and this time he joined in. Sort of. Actually, he said, it did feel like I got a fleeting glimpse of what was at stake for her. For a moment there, I thought we were connecting somehow. Like maybe there was some common ground to find. But, he sighed, but man, did she push my buttons. I don't even think she meant to. Maybe it was me. Maybe it's just my buttons are too pushable. I really do need to learn how to stay unruffled. As long as there are buttons, Jackson, people will push them, said the judge. That's what people do. Here's what I think, though. I think you already know how to be unruffled. You may even be excellent at being unruffled. It's just not your default mode. Not yet. As I said, it takes time to retrain your default response. Time and repetition. Building up your calm muscles, said Jackson. I get it. He took a distracted spoonful of oatmeal, then set the spoon down again. So master your emotions, he began counting off on his fingers. Step into their shoes. Set the frame. How many clauses are there in all? 5, the judge replied, and the 5th clause is what will make it all work. Without the 5th clause in place, the rest of the contract is de facto null and void. But without a solid grasp of clause 4, you can't get to the 5th clause. In natural negotiation, the first 3 clauses are all preparation. The 4th is where the action happens, where the paws meet the pavement. It's this. Communicate with tact and empathy. Empathy, repeated Jackson. How is that different from stepping into the other person's